did the shot, blah, 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 and turned to me. How was that, Mr. Armstrong? I said, it's good, sir. So now cut to 4 days later, the time the Russians get back to England, come back, we're all sitting in the lobby of the hotel watching dailies, and I'm sitting right behind Spielberg, and this shot comes up, and I'm like, oh, please be a miss, please be a miss. And it was a huge miss on screen, and he turned to me and said, well done, Vic, good call. I couldn't do anything wrong after that. Oh, thank
yeah,
you.
that's great.
But that's all part of the job that we do.
And welcome to Cunning Stunts with myself, David Holmes. Ever since I was a teenager, I've been performing as a stuntman on feature films, and for 10 years I was the stunt double for Harry on the Harry Potter films. Whilst preparing a stunt for the final film in the series, I suffered a spinal injury that had the effect of paralysing me from the chest down and ending my career. However, in the decades since the accident, my love of stunts, the stunt performer community and movies has never wavered. So I'm starting this podcast to highlight and pay tribute to the amazing performers who make up the stunt community, giving you first-hand accounts of the work that goes into crafting some of the mind-blowing action scenes you've seen on films such as Star Wars, Mission Impossible, and The Avengers, while also revealing the grit, talent, and bravado of those that risk their lives in the name of entertainment. One quick note, the other voice you'll hear occasionally is Dan Radcliffe, one of my best friends and acting double on the Harry Potter films. He's been sitting in on some of these interviews. Okay, welcome back. And today you're going to hear our interview with stunt icon, Mr. Vic Armstrong. Get ready to hear some movie history, including tales about Superman, Indiana Jones, and what it's like to work with Spielberg, Scorsese, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and Harrison Ford. Vic once dreamed of becoming a jockey, and one day he took a job riding a horse on a film. Since then, he's gone on to perform with some of the most iconic movies of all time. After a very successful career performing, Vic has gone on to become one of the most prolific stunt coordinators the UK has ever produced. Right, that's enough of an intro. Let's get on with the interview. Hope you enjoy. Brilliant. Okay. Vic, firstly, thank you for inviting us to your home. We're in your office at the moment, surrounded by some really amazing memorabilia. Thanks for coming and letting us have a chat with you today. First question, how did you get into the stunt industry?
I think in the old days when I started, most people got in purely by accident. Nowadays, it's a much more focused entry into the business, but I was just a young guy. I didn't know quite what I was going to do. I wanted to be a steeplechase jockey, but I was obviously too big, so I stayed as an amateur jockey. My father was a racehorse trainer. And when I was 17 or so, we had a stuntman who used to come and ride exercise horses with us to stay fit, a guy called Jimmy Lodge. And then one day he called me and said, look, we've got some terrible horses on this movie we're working on. Have you got one we could use? So I lent him a horse who could jump anything, and lent him the horse. The next day they phoned and said, would you come and ride it? So I went, wow. Yeah, this is cool, 20 quid a day, which was a week's wages, you know. And I thought, this is great, this will subsidise my racing. So that's how I sort of drifted into it.
Brilliant. So it was through the horse industry, really. And growing up with horses, did you grow up with horses from a young age, always on them, jumping them, throwing them around?
Absolutely. I grew up, my dad was a racehorse trainer. We moved around a lot, so I didn't have a lot of friends. So I was Johnny No Friends, and I'd get on my pony and play cowboys and Indians on my own, shoot myself, pretend to get shot off as an Indian, falling off the pony. So in retrospect, it was good training for the for the business.
Going on to your credit list, I think the first one I found was 1966, doubling for Gregory Peck. So what was your first out of film set like?
That was amazing. There was a film called Arabesque with Stanley Donen, Gregory Peck and Sophia Loren, which was absolutely phenomenal. You know, I was just gobsmacked walking around on the set. And then we had a guy called Jimmy Lodge who was doubling Gregory for some of the riding. I doubled Alan Bedell and an Arab gentleman in it. And we had a huge horse chase, jumping castle moats and walls and through rivers and all sorts of things. So I'd never forget that.
At what age were you when you were first on a horse?
There's a picture of me over on the wall there. I think I'm probably about 6-7 months old, and a little basket saddle on a donkey. Yeah, and with my daughters, Georgina, my youngest daughter,
I was working in China, and I had a premonition she was going to be born early. I got back anyway in time for the birth, and then she came home, and I've got her sitting in my arms on my old Lusitano horse, 2 days old, and then my granddaughter, this time around, we've got her on a horse at 2 days old, so we started them young.
So, yeah, it's a family tradition.
Yeah, exactly.
The connection with horses.
Yeah.
So just listing some specific stunts that you've done as a performer, stair falls, high falls, fire jobs and motorbike car stunts, wire work, horse falls, they're just a few of them. Was there any stunt job that you'd say no to or you wasn't comfortable with?
I don't think you ever say no to the overall job, but you say no to the way you're going to perform it. As you know, I'm a coordinator as well and a second year director, and I've directed main units. So we have a lot of interaction with directors on how things are going to happen. There was always a way to do something, but not always the way it's sort of wanted to be done.
You invented the fan descender.
Yeah.
Now, I've been on the fan descender, an amazing bit of equipment. Can you just explain to us what it is, please?
Yeah, the fan descender is a very, very simple instrument. It was invented for parachute training, for landing. Instead of having to go up a barrage balloon, a balloon 800 feet and jump out so you've got enough room for the parachute to open, just purely for a parachutist to simulate the landing impact, they came up with this. It was a huge object. It was a spindle with blades on it and a cage around it and wooden spindle. So you could jump out about 30 feet and still hit the ground at the same speed as a parachutist. And I was going to do a picture in Mexico with Ryan O'Neill and Omar Sharif called Green Ice. And Ryan O'Neill and his buddy land on the top of this 400-foot building in Mexico City by hot air balloon, one-man hot air balloons, and they get off the balloon and they blow it up and let it fly away. They get into the building, steal the emeralds, and now they have to jump out, and they wanted some way of getting off the building. And Jack Weiner, the producer, said to me, "Vic, we need to invent something to get them off the building." I said, It's going to be small enough to go up in a one-man hot air balloon. It's going to be simple enough to be made in the back streets of Bogota. It must never have been seen in a movie before. It can be operated by anybody without any special talents. And it has to be totally practical because we want to film it on the way down. I went, "Well, it'll take me 2 or 3 minutes to come up with that, Jack." So I went away, asked all the stuntmen, I gave them all the same question, and some people came up with all, you know, a wooden hut or a grass-roofed hut with an airbag in it, you know, below. And I said, "It's 350 feet we're actually going to jump, so that doesn't work," and this, that, and the other. And met one of the guys, he said, "Oh, there's this thing we saw at the Army display day one day, and it's called a fan descender." So I went to Aldershot, found out about it, and then my dear old Dave Bickers, I gave him the sort of rough idea of what I wanted building. I went to Mexico on a scout and came back, and he built one for me. But he couldn't believe how small the blades were that we were actually going to use, so he'd made them bigger. And you couldn't, you'd come down about 2 miles an hour because it's just a spindle with a cable wrapped around it, and as you drop, like a fishing line, it pulls the spindle and it's air resistant.
Like fan blades on it.
Exactly.
So as you wheel out the cable, the blades use the air resistance to slow the cable down.
Wow.
And it determines the pace of that. It's determined like this.
Yeah, by the size of the blades. But then when we did the Temple of Doom, Indiana Jones, the Temple of Doom, we had to jump off the Obi-Wan Kenobi nightclub where me and Wendy actually smashed the gong up to the window, and we bail out the window, crash down through 3 canopies into a car and drive off. So we're shooting this at night. And by then we'd had the fan descender, been using it regularly. But the DP said to me, "Vic, we're going to have to saw some inches off the fan blade because you're falling too slowly." I said, no, you don't touch that. That's a given. We'll think of some other way. And I used to cycle a lot, and I worked out changing the size of the spindle. The fans turn exactly the same speed, but depending on the size of the spindle, depends how fast the cable comes off it. So the bigger the spindle, the faster the cable comes off, and then we made a slope on it. Dave Bickers and myself made it up, jerry-rigged it on the day out of old camera wedges and things, packing the spindle out and then use the camera wedges to slow it down to the diameter that we wanted when I actually hit the last canopy. So yeah, it was a wonderful invention, but it's sort of been superseded now, but it was good.
Funny you don't come from an engineering background or anything, that was just boys trying to work something out. So continuing on to your performing years, you worked a lot with Harrison Ford, not only on the Indiana Jones series, but the Star Wars films, What was he like? What's he like as a physical actor?
He's a fantastic guy. He really is. He's really is an amazing guy. And always said, you know, I've got the picture up there, and he actually says in it that if I ever learn to talk, meaning me, he's in big trouble. But no, he is an amazing stuntman. He would have made a great stuntman in his own right. He's fabulous. And that was one of the hardest things actually to handle working with him, because he physically wanted to do everything. And I remember on The Last Crusade down in Spain, I was going to do the shot, the old classic cowboy and Indian shot where the Arab guy rides under this rock, and we've got a rock about 15, 20 feet high. As a horse goes underneath, Indiana Jones jumps off, takes the horse and the rider to the ground, smashes the rider, holds the horse down, puts his leg back over it, horse jumps up and he gallops off. So I'm on the top of the rock, saying to the boys, I want some sand there, because if he takes a step forward, I'll be pitched out over there, da da da. Just picking the spot where the sand's going to be, just to break the fall, because in those days you couldn't have anything in shot that shouldn't be there, so the sand.
No, he didn't
crash mats. No. And the horse had to ride over it, of course, and everything. So anyway, I'm aware of a shadow behind me, and he went, no, he's got a very deep voice, move it up now. I said, no, Harrison, I'm going to go that way. I'm going to take the horse for his third stride, so I'll go back that way. If I go this way, you're going to be coming down behind him. No, I'm going to do this. I said, whoa, hold on a minute. And I got down off the rock with him. I said, Harrison, I said, you know, you're earning good money on this show. He went, yeah. I said, I'm a stuntman. I get extra every time I do a stunt. You keep doing the stunts, I'm not going to make anything. And he went, oh, gee, Vic, I'm sorry. Next time, kick me in the ass when I'm so stupid. I'm sorry, buddy. Then I did the stunt. He could have done it, but I was trying to say, you know, a horse could throw his head up, knock your teeth out, yeah. All sorts of things go wrong. But I had to blackmail him.
Right, totally that's a nice wrong. Way of
yes, exactly.
Out of doing it.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
But he's such a great guy. One of the things he did there at the end of that shoot, he said, Vic, could I throw a little party for your stunt guys? I went, sure, we love a party, absolutely. And as the days went on, he said, you know, could I ask Sean and Steven, Spielberg and Connery? And I went, yeah, of course you can, absolutely, ask who you like. In the end, he's asked the whole crew. I'm thinking, phew, it's going to be a costly. And he's picked the best nightclub in El Maria. Everything's laid on. So we go to the party. There's filet mignon, there's lobsters, there's everything. I'm thinking, oh, my God. 50-50, OK. He had actually invites made out, Vic Armstrong and Harrison Ford, my name at the top. So it was the stunt guys inviting everybody.
You were
expecting
half the bill, were you?
I was. Oh, my God. Anyway, so come Monday morning, took Sunday to get over it all. We had a hell of a night. It was great. The whole crew were there. Monday morning, I said to Harrison, I said, look, buddy, you better give me the bill for Saturday. He said, Bill, what bill are you talking about? I said, the party Saturday. He went, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't remember. And it was his way of actually having a party, but without saying, I'm Harrison Ford, I'm throwing a party for everybody.
Right,
you know, it was
nice.
Really sweet.
Oh, yeah, nice. Now, going back to, you've moved on to main unit director throughout your career progress in stunts. Who are better to work with, stunt guys or actors?
As acting goes, actors. I love working with actors, I've got to say. You know, I'd the last one I did, I had Ving Rhames, Linda Hamilton, and William Shatner.
Oh, cool.
It was just wonderful. Yeah. And, you know, because acting is something I'm in awe of, because I can't do it. I learnt on my first or second picture in Switzerland in '66, I can't act. There's something about it, it's, you know.
It's not a gift for stunties, really.
It's not.
Performance is part of our job.
Yeah.
But dialogue is a no-go.
It's really strange because I can mimic Harrison, I can mimic the people I'm doubling, you know, the movement, the way you walk, the way you run, but delivering dialogue is a totally different thing, or not even the dialogue, just the look, and, you know, I'm totally in awe of actors. And
I think
so,
actors are in awe of stuntmen as well. I think there's a mutual sort of, there's a very much, a, like, all the actors I know love working with stunts and doing stunts, and, yeah.
And they are two such totally different jobs, you know, and I think you have to accept that fact, you know, and but there are some that cross over, which is brilliant, but no, I've never, of those days, never ever wanted to act. Thank goodness I couldn't. But there are a lot of actors that are really, really good at stunts. You know, Tom has been phenomenal, you know, things we've done with him. Arnie, you know, is as tough as they come, doing Total Recall, he's doing a fight, he got kicked on the finger, broke the fingertip. Finished the day out, went to hospital, insisted on a removable splint, carried on with the fight the next day, just pulled the splint off in between and carried on. Just one of the toughest. And Red Sonja in Rome, he had to run down this wooden tree trunk and jump onto a horse. And of course, horses being horses, decided the move is using midair. He landed on the side of it, went underneath, and it just tap danced all over him. All he had was a fur loincloth on. He had footprints all over him from the horse. Got up there and did it again. Tough as nails, you know. Wow. Great, great guys. That's and Harrison, as I say, he's up there for everything. And the great thing with Harrison, he's very, very contributive for the whole process when we're doing the fight. In, like, on the revolving, on the moving conveyor belt where he goes through the stone crusher, and we kill poor old Pat Roach again and again, you know. I've killed him in so many movies, bless him. He's very, comes up with great ideas as well. So I love the collaboration of doing that with an actor. It's great. So I love the collaborative effort with when you do get somebody like that and working it all out, you know. It's terrific. And Spielberg used to be like that, you know. It's great. When the first time I met Spielberg was on Raiders, and I was working in Mexico, and I flew out to meet them in Tunisia. So my first proper job for him was coordinating the fight around the revolving wing, that big flying wingy thing, where he's again fighting Pat Roach, who I'd fought for 40 odd years. I beat him every time. And the first thing it was, in those days there was no video playback, so you have to get right down, look straight down the lens. If there's a punch, you have to see whether it's a miss or a hit or reactions on time and everything else, but you've got a split second to do it as you're looking down the lens, and there's cameraman's head in the way, operator's head in the way. You could be on your game, you know. I'll never forget the first day on Raiders when I was doing that. It was just before lunch and it's blistering hot. We used to go to work at 2 or 3 in the morning, so we'd wrap at 2 in the afternoon because it was so hot down in Tunisia. And I'm looking down the lens, and Harrison threw a punch, popped old Pat Roach on the nose, and Stephen said, "That's great, okay, that's it, that's lunch, guys." I'm like, "Well, excuse me, sir, who are you?" And I said, "I'm Vic Armstrong. I'm replacing Peter Diamond because he's off doing the second unit. I'm coordinating this bit." I said, "I think that was a miss." He said, "That was a hit. I think it was a miss." Now my heart's going, "Oh my God, okay." And he went very sarcastic, "Okay, let's do it again." Did the shot, blah, blah, blah. And turned to me, "How was that, Mr. Armstrong?" I said, "It's good, sir." So now cut to 4 days later, the time the Rushes get back to England, come back, we're all sitting in the lobby of the hotel watching dailies, and I'm sitting right behind Spielberg, and this shot comes up, and I'm like, "Oh, please be a miss, please be a miss." And it was a huge miss on screen, and he turned to me and said, "Well done, Vic, good call." I couldn't do anything wrong after that. Oh, thank you.
that's great.
But that's all part of the job that we do.
You went on to have a working relationship with Spielberg quite a few times, didn't you?
I did, yeah, we did those three, we did Empire of the Sun, wonderful. I think there was a wonderful period in his filmmaking as well. Yeah. It was just brilliant.
It's probably hard to estimate, but like, what's your total tally of credits as in terms of a number? Like, where would that even be? I mean, well over
400.
300, 400. Mm-hmm. Wow.
It's 53 years now, you know, it's going on a bit.
You must be one of the most successful stuntmen in the world.
Yeah.
On what movies you've been attached to with their box office takings.
It's fate. As we all know, fate has an amazing guide on all our lives, and it was fate that I got into the business, but it was fate that I was at the top of my game when indie was happening, when Bond was ready for me, when I did Superman 1 and 2, so I was fit, you know, I was fit and ready to rock and roll, so at the right time when those genres are kicking off, so.
And just wanted to go back to indie, because I watched the action sequence with the tank the other day. How do you find out how to jump from a horse to a tank? Because it's a really sketchy job.
It is, and out of all the things I've done, yeah, I did a 100-foot fall on one of the Final Conflict movies. I actually directed it. I was the second unit director, and doubling the monk on the horse that rears up and throws him off a 100-foot viaduct. And that was scary, but to me, one of the technical ones was the horse jump, as you say, on the Last Crusade. I think 99% of all my injuries, and I'm a horseman, 99% of all my injuries have come from horses, broken my arm, a leg, you know, odds and ends. And so that one was difficult, and we did it in Spain. I had a good old horse called Huracan. I'd used him on Rambo, took him out to Israel. Good stallion that actually Harrison tried to buy, loved him so much. And for 3 months, we'd have the manure heap, and I'd simulate the cliff edge, and I'd... Because the hardest thing was getting the horse galloping at the right pace to stay with the tank, dropping the reins, standing up on the saddle and kicking off. You did it all in one stride, as it were, but the horse had to be absolutely constant. If we go too far this way, because we'd cut the cliff out, it was very unstable on the edge, but we had to cut it to get it vertical, get the tank close, to make it look as though it's close.
It was a real tank as well, not a prop tank.
No, a real tank, and it was hard on the top, all metal.
I saw the bounce when you connected.
When the wind goes out of you. But I had the horse close enough so I could make the jump. It was still 18 feet, and I had to travel laterally, but not too close so he could slip down and get us both squished behind the tank. But all the same time, I didn't want him to run out to the left as I took off and drop me into the thing. So it took about 3 months every day counting him up and doing the speed and jumping into manure. So,
wow.
Living in.
So, Vic, I wanted to go on and talk about your time as the Superman stunt double, doubling Christopher Reeve. I mean, what are your memories of those films?
Very happy memories, I must say. You know, I was on it from day one before they'd even cast Christopher Reeves. So, Alf Joint, who's a great partner of mine, we'd just finished A Bridge Too Far in Holland. So we're on a roll. We were a great team, actually. And Alf was a gymnast in the PTI in the army and everything else. So he had a great idea of things that you could physically do. Because when we started the movie, we wanted to sort of reinvent how Superman flew. Although when we did it, we were inventing it as we went along with blue screen, the advent of lots of technology that wasn't there before. But it was exciting to be in at Ground Zero when we had Chris Reeves, when he first joined us, you know, we had a gym and worked him out and everything else. So it was nice to see how he evolved through the movie. And one heck of an actor, I've got to say, he was amazing. He was the epitome of Superman to me, you know, the one in New York when he's Clark Kent and then he goes in the revolving door and comes out as Superman. You know, it's almost what you see, you know, for real. It's just an amazing character.
Were you a fan of the character in the comic book series before starting on the film?
Yeah, in as much as, yeah, as a kid, it was the sort of one that I really, really didn't read many comics, but it was one that I was very au fait with, yeah, absolutely.
So, obviously, you've worked with some amazing directors. I just want to reel a few of them off. Obviously, Steven Spielberg, Martin Scorsese, Ridley Scott, David Lean, Richard Attenborough. That's just a few of them. But which of the directors did you learn the most from working with?
I think you learn from every director. Each one is different. Scorsese was absolutely wonderful to work with. Slowly, we met each other and we talked, and he'd be specific about what he wanted and the reasons we're doing these cuts, which is why I pick him out as one of the guys that I learned a lot from. He's actually shooting things as cuts, not just what's the best dynamic way to get this fall, this action. Right. It's a specific cut that goes into some other part of the movie, another part of the movie. And it was a fantastic experience for me, actually. And I got on so well with him. We'd all meet every Saturday at Cinecittà, and he'd have one of his films he's renovated, he's a conservationist film, and we'd play that. And it was just such a wonderful experience, the whole film.
I've heard he does that. He has like a film club where he just plays amazing things you never know.
Brilliant. And he knows more about film than anybody I've ever known. Before I went out there, once I knew I was going to do the film, he sent a stack of tapes around, Mother Earth, Odessa, all these Eisenstein films. And I was supposed to watch them all. So, Julie, I did them, and it was Christmas time. I'll never forget, the kids are coming in. So, what are you watching, Dad? And they look at me and go, okay, see you later, Dad. When they're out there. But I had to watch the whole thing, you know? But it's just as well I did, because when we started shooting the sequence, he'd say, you know, there's such and such from the Odessa, you know? Yeah. And I go, oh, okay. Or from these other things, Mother, and what was the other one? Oh, there's three famous films. But I had to know all those bits because they were the cuts, and we actually invented a new angle as well. We used to call it the Russian angle. And, you know, you have a Dutch angle and everything else.
What's the Russian?
Straight up the nostrils.
Oh, right.
It's a wide angle lens like that. And it was quite funny because all those Russian films, they didn't have the money or whatever, so their close-ups would be like that. So they didn't have to shoot this way and fill in the background. They had no money, so they shoot straight up at the sky. And you notice they're all straight up their nostrils and things, but it's very dynamic. Mm. So we'd call it our Russian angle, and it became part of the film speak with us. You know, a Dutch angle, Russian angle, and you know, Chinese, whatever. So it was quite funny, but I learned an awful lot from him, and he was a wonderful guy. And he was quite funny because one day I asked him, I said, Marty, you know, I love all your down shots. There's a lot of down shots, geography sort of things. I said, that's fantastic. You know, what sort of prompts that? And he said, well, Vic, when I was a little guy, I wasn't very big and I had asthma and I couldn't go outside. If I did, the guys would punch me on the nose. So I used to stand on my balcony and watch them fighting and watch that. And that's how I saw the world. Oh. That's how he got this vision for these high shots. That's his childhood. It's just wonderful.
Wicked.
Absolutely wonderful gentleman.
And what's Ridley Scott like to work with?
Ridley is fantastic. The work ethic is phenomenal.
Yeah.
Absolutely phenomenal. A totally different director to Scorsese. His is more about the visual effect and everything else, rather than, I guess, the performance as well, but it's more the visual for him from his background as a commercial.
I've heard if you ask Ridley Scott a question, he might draw you the answer.
Oh, yeah.
He could just do a storyboard then and there to show you something.
Yeah. No, he's a fantastic storyboard artist and everything else in his own right.
So, yeah, in your career, you saw the advent of visual effects come into the fold of filmmaking. Do you think that's added to stunt work or risk taking some of the work away from us?
I think it's six of one and half a dozen of the other. I'm a great advocate of visual effects used exactly as a visual effect. What I don't agree with is using them as an entity to make a film with. If you don't know how to do something, we'll do it in visual effects, in other words, creating sequences and whole things. And, you know, I've worked on some very, very visual effects intense movies like Starship Troopers. That was quite a groundbreaking movie in its day. And I went up to San Francisco for Phil Tippett, who was the visual effects guru at the time, because they were still working out how to do some of the stuff. But we had to have real physical action interacting with the monsters and everything else, so we were working out how to do it and that sort of thing. And I totally think it's a wonderful, wonderful tool. I always look at it as my get-out-of-jail-free card. When I break down a sequence, you look at it, and I always imagine we can do it for real. And when it comes to the bit where the guy cycles off the top of the Eiffel Tower on fire on a bicycle and lands on a barge in the Seine and is safe, you know you have to make some sort of adjustments here. How are you going to do it? How visual effects can help you? And nowadays it can help you, you know, tenfold with the eradication of wires and things like that. And I always say, to me, visual effects are like morphine. Morphine is an incredible drug used in the right quantities for the right ailment. It's saved people's lives, it's made people more comfortable, but used and abused and overused, it's a killer, literally, and that's what visual effects can do for a movie.
Great way of looking at it.
Yeah.
And, you know, when we did Superman, we used to fly on piano wires, single-strand piano wires, we wouldn't even bow down cable, just single-strand, unless we did the big high ones, then we'd have sort of quarter-inch or eighth-inch. But normal flying was piano-wise, and when one went, the other one went instantly because the overload of weight on it, and you plant it on the ground. But nowadays, you can have them as, you know, Tech 12 as thick as my finger, and it can lift a Land Rover up, you know, and it's helped in that respect, but it is abused an awful lot.
Do you think that those big stunts, I'm thinking of Wayne Michaels doing the dam jump for you.
Phenomenal.
Gary Powell ramping the tank through the wall on the Bond. Those big, massive stunts, do you think visual effects are going to slowly whittle those out? I mean, nowadays, because you can cheat it, would you still ask a performer to do it?
That's an awful question. I'd say I wouldn't want to cheat it if I could. If it's at all possible, I'd like to do it for real. And another one there you mentioned was Gary Powell driving the jet boat on the Bond, where he does a barrel roll. You know, we worked for ages to get that thing to barrel roll. To get the speed to get it to flip was phenomenal, but it was a whole mixture of people putting their advice in. And Dave Bickers, we couldn't get the thing to flip completely over. It would always turn onto its roof and crash like that.
The rehearsal where Gary goes
into the boxes. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, if he's doing that at racing speed, which is what we're doing on the Thames, it would have taken his head off. So it's terrifying, you know? And Dave Bickers came up with this idea of having little nitrogen blast down and nitrogen blast up. He said, if that boat was hanging on a piece of cotton or rope, you could make it spin with one finger.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah. He said, so if it's going through the air, we could go, and that would make it flip, rather than trying to ramp it.
Yeah.
And that's all we had to do was a ramp to get it airborne. But Gary had impeccable timing. If he got it wrong, he's still going to go in upside down or half in and, you know, kill him. So that was terrifying. But the fact that it's done like that, it gives it an organic realism, I think, and it's fantastic. But another example, I think, of something shot for real as much as you can was on Tomorrow Never Dies, where Jean-Pierre Goy jumps a motorcycle over the helicopter from roof to roof in Saigon. And we could have easily done that, A, on cables, all the way on cables,
yeah.
Sort of get the parabolic curve sorted out, or we could have done it all CG, but I wanted him to jump it for real, and the only thing that wasn't real was the roof he was landing on. It was just cardboard boxes, and the helicopter was a dummy, a real helicopter with no blades on it. We'd made a difference. He'd gone through and he'd been killed anyway, so it was just for practicality reasons. We didn't have a real helicopter floating there.
Right.
And what we did, we had the street built over in St Albans. We knew the 100-odd feet, whatever it was, you're going to jump, and the run-up was going to be here. So I said, OK, well, now we need to rehearse this, but that roof has to be prepared. The whole roof has to be taken out. The facade has to be softened in case he drops short and goes through the front of it. So all has to be softened. So while they were working on that, we turned the bike around and ran the same distance as coming this way, but ran this way, and we had 10,000 cardboard boxes here, and we'd jump, and he'd work out what gear he's in, what revs he's doing to know what he was going to jump. But every time he landed, it was a monumental thing to get a crane, to get the bike out of the stack of boxes, rebuild the boxes, put them in, but we rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed. So when we came to shoot it, what you see is a guy and a girl on a motorbike, and we cut the moment it hits the roof, because then the roof caves in.
Who's
and he goes into the box.
Back?
Wendy.
Yeah. Oh, was it?
Yeah. Wow. And Jean-Pierre was wonderful, this fantastic motorcyclist. He said to me one day, Vic, I'm so honoured that you let me do these dangerous things with your wife.
Yeah,
I said, yes, Jean-Pierre, you don't know how much I have insured for.
No, but that is a lot of trust.
I mean, your whole family has been around stunts pretty much your whole life. Do you ever worry, ever?
It's not about myself, because I know I can do and everything else, but I do about the kids, yeah, I do, very, very much so.
Speaking of family and stuff, you've committed your life to the film industry, Wendy has, your children have. Did you ever find that it was quite hard to struggle with a work-life balance? Did you miss birthdays and Christmases and stuff?
It is. We've been successful. I've got a nice house in LA. I've got this place and looked after the kids and everything else. But you suddenly realise what sacrifices you do pay. And funnily enough, I'm realising it like mad at the moment, having two young grandkids. My daughter Georgie's got a little boy who's 12 weeks old, and then Nina's got little Allegra who's 14 months old. But I see Allegra every morning. I've been watching her learn to walk and do this, and learning to talk, and the teeth coming through. I missed all of that with my kids, although they travelled the world with me. We used to travel, I'd like King Farouk. I'd have the four kids, my mother would come and look after them, two nannies, Wendy and me. We went out to dinner, it'd be three taxi job at night to go out to dinner. And they did travel the world, and they loved it, but it's still not same as being at home, Plus, it's tough on them when people say, oh, it must be wonderful for the kids to go and live in a hotel for 3 months. It's horrible for them. They can't have all their toys. They haven't got their friends with them. They're out of their comfort zone. They're only being there because we're being selfish, wanting them there. Right. It's a strange...
I'm going to do all the same things.
Then the payoff is the other end of the scale.
Right.
You could have a regular job and you wouldn't have the cars and the houses and the horses and the ponies and...
And the life experience.
And the life experience. Yeah. It's a trade-off, yeah.
It's an interesting job.
And I do think travel is one of the greatest experiences in the world and educations in the world. I went to Africa when I was 9 years old as a kid. Mum and Dad moved out there to Kenya just when the Mau Mau was kicking off. Bad timing. So I lived there for a year. I didn't go to school for a year. Then I came home, I went to 23 different schools because we moved around a lot, buying and selling houses, trying to make the money back they'd lost going to Africa. And I still left before I was 15 because I started racing and I thought, I've learned enough at school. But I do credit that travelling with giving me an education or a common sense that stands you in good stead rather than just numerical and...
Oh, yeah, I think particularly for young kids, traveling is amazing.
Wonderful.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, yeah, you sacrifice an awful lot, yeah. Davey, when you do that sort of thing, but it's a trade-off.
I'd just love to ask I'm sure you've had probably injuries over the years that you've had to recover from or deal with, or when you're dealing with that, or when you're just, standing... or, hanging from a ceiling about to plunge through a hole in Grand Central Station roof and you're just having that moment before a stunt. Like, what is it that you love about it that makes that moment worth it every time?
Yeah, I used to think there was something wrong with me because I'd be nervous as anything the night before and even on the day. But you had your own confidence, your own ability. And I started realising it wasn't the worry about getting hurt. A stuntman's biggest worry is screwing up the shot. Because normally when there's a big stunt going to happen, the word's out, everybody's there, and it's talked about for days and weeks and this and that and the other. An actor, yourself, whoever, can go on the set, you can fluff a line. Cut, okay, one more time. No matter how big or how little, you know, I did Henry V with Ken Branagh and some of the greatest actors in the world, but once or twice, very rarely, they would fluff a line in these great dialogues. Doesn't matter, we go again. Whereas a stunt, normally, you've probably got a couple, you know, like a Bond, one of those huge great things on Bond that one person's movement triggers this whole cacophony of explosions. There's hundreds of thousands of dollars blown out the window or blown up if you get it wrong. And you're the only person in the firing line, it's you. And of course, everybody that's on the set watching can do the job better than you. It's, no matter what your job is, even in a football match, they can all score the goal better than the guy that scored it and da 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 da. You know, there's a huge armchair army, but everybody thinks they can do it until you know, get in front of the cameras and it's your neck on the line. So there's it's the fear of failure, because if it does go wrong, maybe you slip at the last moment or you do it and somebody else's time is wrong, it's your fault. And it's the sense of responsibility for that and failure, I think, that's the biggest fear that I found anyway, yeah.
Thank you so much.
No worries. That was really
my pleasure, my pleasure. Good man.
Okay, thanks again to Vic for joining us, and also to Nina and Wendy in making up this special family series of Cunning Stunts. That's it for now. We'll be back again very soon. Until then, thanks for listening and take care. Ripple Production podcast series produced by myself, David Holmes, and Amy Stairs. Sound recording, editor, and music by Joe Lamb. To find out more about us, please visit our website, www.rippleproductions.co.uk, or follow us on Facebook and Instagram.